everybody, and welcome to the latest edition of the TeachNet podcast. Today, we are delighted to be joined by Jared Brown. Jared is based in Fexco in Killorglin. Jared, it's a pleasure to have you, and maybe you'll introduce yourself and give us a little bit of background to you and the work you're involved in.
Thanks, Michael. Yeah, pretty glad to have the opportunity to chat. So Jared Brown is the name. So I'm the head of privacy and AI governance in the Fexco Group in County Kerry. So we're a corporate in about 50 locations globally. So my background, I guess, is work-wise is compliance, privacy, data protection, and in the last 3 to 4 years, then AI governance as well, in line with the explosion in that technology. But I suppose my first passion or start in life was philosophy. So I actually did a pure philosophy degree in Dublin, and then I did a pure philosophy master's in UCD, specializing in German existentialism. And I also taught philosophy then in the further education system in Ireland for 5 years as well with adults. So that's the whole mixture that goes into the background.
Fantastic. It strikes me in talking to people over the last number of years that there's a lot of relevance between philosophy and AI. Would you agree?
Yeah, there is. And I mean, there were lots of jokes about philosophy graduates in college and the jobs that you won't be getting afterwards. But AI, funnily enough, has brought philosophy back full circle as one of the more relevant and necessary qualifications. And even some of the large technology companies in the US have started looking for philosophy graduates. But you're getting into, I suppose, AI is such a foundational thing. It opens up questions like, what is a human being? What is thinking? What is human consciousness? What does it mean to learn? These are all fundamental philosophy questions, 2,000 years old, in fact. AI is just really drawing them back out into significance again.
But before we get into a few of those, and today we are going to be talking about AI and its impact on things like those fundamental questions like what is learning and even what is education. You also have been very active at a European level in the whole area of AI. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the work you've been doing there as well?
I've been working with a body called SEDPO in Brussels for 5 years now. I'm the chair of the AI working group there. So we develop a lot of papers on AI governance. We put in position papers to the Commission. We work with the European Commission on a number of committees. And then also for the last year or so, I've been working with the EU AI office on the development of guidelines for general purpose AI. So in other words, for the likes of OpenAI and Google Gemini and so on. So I have a mixture of the day job, if you like, and then also the involvement with the associations in Brussels and with the European institutions.
Perfect. And you've also been working with us on the development of some new micro qualifications in this whole area with Solus and with a number of other partners. And we have a level 6 that's in production at the moment. And you've been a huge source of guidance and content for that level 6. So today, I look forward to broadening out our discussions. So I suppose AI, we were chatting off air before we started, and I was mentioning that a colleague of mine in Nantes University talks about AI as an unwelcome guest in education. And recently, I was at an event where people were talking about AI-free education is no longer possible because these tools are now so pervasive. They're on our phones, they're on our laptops, both within and outside of school. There's this need for us to be really critical about when we use them or if we use them and how we might even use them. So I suppose from your perspective and where you're sitting, and I know you have children yourself as well in the school system, what do you see as the potential benefits? We'll start with the benefits of AI in education and particularly to support learning.
Yeah, I think, and just on your colleague's comments from Nantes, the unwelcome guest, and the reality is that education was possibly the most affected in November 22 when ChatGPT came out, and in the middle of the college year. And I suppose the background is that the release strategy of the big tech companies is easier to ask for forgiveness than look for permission, right? So this is the technocratic, I suppose, society we live in. So the technology lands, and then we mop up. So the mop-up job for education has been one major task. So I think it's a given that there's positives.
I might just add in there, somebody else recently said to me that it's actually one of the largest social experiments that's happening right, you know, we didn't look for it, but it's happening right before our eyes. We have to try and get on and deal with this because it's arrived.
Yeah, exactly. And this again goes, I mean, it's a tangential topic, but the release strategy, for example, of OpenAI and ChatGPT was It's a consumer-led AI app. They released it into the wild knowing that it was going to iterate in the hands of the world. The only problem with that is you essentially socialize all the risks onto the world. So this is kind of learn as we go and try to cope with the damage. It wouldn't be my way of running education or society, right? But it is what we have. So your focus now is on rear guard actions and trying to contain this. Yes. You know, you're not putting the genie back in the bottle, but you need to try and restrict how unruly the genie gets, right?
Yeah.
Our midst. Yeah. But if you think of the positives, look, there are positives. And if we think about the legwork side of education, where researchers need to do a huge amount of initial work to purely get together sources, references, a program, an application for funding, you can see it having use in all of those things. That's common sense. A teacher or a lecturer, again, can use it as a way of beginning the design of learning programs, things like that, designing lesson plans. I'm sure teachers will tell you that they have a lot of admin, they have a lot of preparatory work, and maybe they'd love to spend more time teaching with the children or the students or whatever it is. So there's clearly uses in all of those. The only thing I would say is that I'd see it being used most positively where it doesn't erode the core functions of learning. A teacher teaches and a student learns. The more it starts to erode those, then we are looking at something very different forming before our eyes, really.
Yeah, no. And I think, again, there's a lot of discussion at the moment around, I think there's a lot more criticality coming into the discussion, the discussions I'm participating in. And, you know, looking very carefully at the tasks, because I think, you know, it's more down to tasks, and you've listed a number of tasks there that people who listen to us regularly, we've gone into in detail in the past. And it is like that companion or that assistant role that it can help. And, you know, definitely on the research from my own perspective, I find it hugely valuable. But it's this offloading. What are the tasks we should or could offload to this technology? I mean, somebody recently said to me, look, I offloaded, they were going to a funeral and they needed to find their way to a church in Dublin. And they offloaded the task of the directions to Google Maps. And they were quite happy to do that. But that's very different to offloading learning and teachers offloading tasks that really they should retain for themselves to a machine. I suppose, do you want to say a little bit on that?
Yeah, and I suppose we're trying to focus really on deep learning, right? So there's a difference between which bus do I get to get into the city centre and what is the meaning of War and Peace or Crime and Punishment, right? I need to read those books if I want to get the meaning of those, and that's deep learning. It's okay, right? For the practicalities of living and making everything easier, we can offload practical tasks like all of that. I mean, I did have a friend who went to Salzburg recently and offloaded the task of which bus to get, and they ended up on the wrong end of the city. That's all I'll say. So look, I think the cognitive offloading is both a kind of a social and a psychological risk, but it also comes down to the biology of it. If we think about, so there's lots of studies already showing now demonstrative cognitive decline in people who over-rely, particularly on generative AI. And if we look at the MIT study from earlier in the year, it looked at the impact of learning on traditional approach, so offline, a kind of halfway house, which is using Google search, which is what we're all used to, and third one using chatbots, generative AI. And what they were able to show was a distinct lower level of theta, alpha, delta wave activity in the people who used AI, meaning they didn't really engage with the process in any way, right? So they press the button, do the essay for me, please. Essay comes out the other end, I submit it, job done. But I suppose the really important bit, right, is deep engagement engages that part of the brain, that brain connectivity, those waves happen, and deep learning processes and memory processes are triggered.
Yeah.
So surprise, surprise, I remembered what I actually put into the essay and what I learned as well. So that cognitive offloading part is really critical. So let's say AI is being used or has a role, but if your brain is not significantly engaged, then the evidence suggests that we're going to get to this outcome where you're not remembering anything. And of course, if you're not remembering anything, you're reinforcing your dependence on the technology, because what you have to do, well, I have to go back again and ask it, what does this mean, or what's the answer to such and such a question? So I think And if we think of the different age groups then, and I guess we discussed it beforehand, certainly we'd want to be very wary that this gets in at the early stages of education, because that's brain development stage, which is a whole different story.
Yeah, so a couple of points on that. I think this is a very, again, I think we're now getting, to me, a lot of the discussions around AI are getting to more fund. We're now starting to get into, you know, the kind of the hype cycle. We're quite a ways in it now at this stage. And we're starting to get into more deeper questions. And again, and I'd like us to go a little bit deeper on the learning bit. I mean, I think it's opening up, again, bigger questions around what is education? What is the purpose of school? And we know there are, you know, there's things happening in the US. There's the alpha school movement where they're not having any teachers and they're going to be taught by AI. I won't get into that today. But, you know, and it also has implications for the role of the teacher and the role of the learner. And, you know, you've touched on some of those already. But I suppose going back to your own earlier background in the philosophy, in the world of philosophy, and for you, what is learning? What do you see as learning? And are there different types of learning when we are using different technologies? Let's not forget that a book is a technology, it's a tool. So, but it's a very different type of tool from, say, ChatGPT or Copilot or Gemini or whatever you have in yourself.
Go back in history, I suppose, and try to give it a bit more perspective. Even when Gutenberg invented the printing press, it was what, 1482, something around like that. There were people saying, oh my God, we can't unleash books and wisdom on the uneducated masses. Imagine the damage that's going to do. And of course, it's quite the opposite, right? It was a transformative effect that books could get out to more people. So we try and keep a little bit of balance, I suppose, in the sense that there might be some positives, right, from AI as well that we're automatically discounting. But if we think about what happened with Google and the internet and search, right? So fair enough, the internet is a massive change, okay? But you're still able to pretty safely use the metaphor that the internet is a digital library, right? So previously I walked into the library, pulled a book off the shelf and read it. So what could go wrong, right? And there I am reading. The internet was not massively different. I'm just going to go online and get a digital article now on Encyclopedia Britannica, and I go off and read it. So not a massive change, still learning. What we have now with AI and generative AI is quite different from Google search or the internet. This is auto-generating everything for me and in serious danger of replacing the learning process. Like I've written books and published books, and the internet was an enormous help in doing that. I could find newspaper articles in Australia, wherever, online in databases. Incredible. But I still engaged with it and had to learn. And I suppose if we to go back even further again in history, then to the ancient Greeks and to Plato and Socrates. So Socrates believed in learning through conversation. So he didn't write anything down. And I mean, if people are probably familiar with the Acropolis, he walked around the Acropolis in ancient Athens, engaging everybody in conversation. But what's interesting about Plato and Socrates was they believed in the human-to-human engagement as the learning process. And Plato actually called it the philosophical flame, that it passes from one soul to the other. And how does it pass from one to the other? It's true inspiration. So we should never forget that a great teacher inspires his students to learn. Socrates always said was that, and I'm paraphrasing, a teacher doesn't open up the student's head and pour the knowledge in and close it again and off they go. A great teacher inspires and actually coaxes knowledge out of the student that's already there and nascent abilities. But the big difficulty we have with technology and certainly with AI is that it will turn it all into a passive experience, can't serve up the knowledge. So like, I suppose we have to remember what we are and what have we been doing for 200,000 years. Humans have been learning from humans. Like, do we seriously think that there would be no consequences that we could rock up all of a sudden on Monday and change that? And the only other thing I'd say is, and I've experienced this firsthand, and I think it is the most wonderful part of learning, is that learning happens in a community of students with other students.
So just on that, and just sticking with Socrates, and again, many of the people listening to our chat would be very familiar with dialogic teaching, for example. Jared is a, you know, it's a kind of a label that we use. And in the Irish system across our post-primary schools, many of them use a thing called the Magenta Principles, which was developed by a chap called Mike Hughes. You know, it's about dialogue and it's about discussion and critical discussion, not having a chat, but discussion. I'm just thinking as well, in this world, again, we're doing a lot of work in H2 learning, on European projects around data literacy and generative AI, or even just literacy in general. And the whole, this critical perspective, again, Socrates would have been big into the questioning piece. And I think this is actually making a comeback in the world of generative AI. People are saying, yeah, you know, your story there of your colleague that he got the wrong directions or he was fed the wrong directions, that critical perspective piece and the need to be able to ask the right questions seems to me to be coming back into vogue.
In the sense that chatbots are conversational by their very nature. Yeah, I knew you were going to ask this, actually.
Well, but I'm also thinking, even not just going there initially, but yeah, I mean, that iterative piece around discussion. Yeah. I'm thinking more about, okay, questioning and these chatbots, or these generative tools. I mean, the very first one is, should I even use it, right? And that kind of questioning, you know, should I be doing the Google search? Should I actually, is this a task that's actually better suited to using generative AI? And then those questions I should be asking myself when I put the prompt together, and most importantly, the output piece. I suppose that's kind of where I'm thinking at the moment.
Yeah. The main thing is that your critical faculties would be engaged in the learning process. What do I want to learn and how do I want to learn it and what means would I use to learn it? And obviously, it may not be the outcome, but the worst of all outcomes would be that we have become so passive that we are just recipients of the knowledge through generative AI. And I suppose there is a sliver of a Socratic approach in there in that you're meant to interrogate the chatbot and ask more questions. It just remains to be seen how much that develops into more active thinking and how much we just end up lying down as passive consumers.
And I think, you know, there's a couple of things there. I mean, one of the problems that we have in education globally at the moment is disengagement or lack of engagement sometimes from our learners, young people that in particular. So I think this notion of, you know, the engagement, the questioning and not having them passive, and this whole idea of getting them more actively engaged in their own learning is coming more and more to the fore. But I jumped in there when you were talking about Socrates. Anything that we can learn from Plato coming out from this and applying it to the modern day with the arrival of generative AI?
Yeah, well, the interesting part with Plato, and I suppose he's a more wide-ranging thinker than Socrates and produced an awful lot of text. He actually, there's maybe about 24 dialogues attributed to him. But he has a famous letter, the seventh letter, I think it is, where he says that he hints that most of his important ideas, he never committed them to paper because he ultimately felt that the highest truths or wisdom were not fit for being turned into stone on paper and that people would simply misunderstand the dynamic and alive nature of those truths by putting them on paper. So he had this unusual, difficult relationship with the written word and with text. He reluctantly committed all of these ideas to books. But this letter that he wrote tells you what he really thought. So I think with Plato, we can see the suspicion of the medium, right? That the medium of learning can actually shape how we learn. And again, there's a famous phrase from Marshall McLuhan that the medium is the message. Now, that's not quite education, but a sector. But again, that we don't trivialize how the medium could actually entirely shape the experience.
Yes.
And we are here today with a brand new medium, for sure.
And I'm thinking now we're kind of wrapping here already, but there's so much I know that I would love to come back to. But I suppose the reality is the genie is out of the bottle, as you said yourself. Okay. So, you know, how, and I think a lot of our teachers and a lot of our school leaders and others, those who are involved in teacher education, are trying to figure out, okay, is there a place for these technologies in learning? I mean, some of the examples we gave at the outset were more to do with efficiencies about time and other things. But I wonder, do you have any thoughts about what deep learning might look like in the age of AI?
Yeah, so I think that the thing about deep learning is it depends on the flow state, really, being achieved. The problem we have with technology is that technology tends to discourage a flow state. So the easiest way to describe the flow state is the person in the corner of the room reading the book who's forgotten the rest of the world. That's perfect. That's a deep level of learning where a lot of memory activities will be triggered, whereas our engagement with technology is skimming. So we flick and flick and flick and flick through sources of information. And that keeps eroding attention and our ability to pay attention. So attention is our absolute most prized resource at the moment. but the one that is in most danger of vanishing. And this is not just AI, this is just any engagement to technology. It can erode that ability to pay attention. And there's an excellent book on this, Stolen Focus, Why We Can't Pay Attention, by Yohan Harari. And you'll want to put your phone away in a safe after reading it. And it will inspire you to go back to that deep learning and to the flow state. So I don't quite know yet how is AI going to integrate with deep learning and get us to a place where that flow state can happen.
Yeah, but I had the privilege a few weeks ago to listen to speakers from the OECD, UNESCO, Council of Europe and others. And they were very much on this line that you were talking about. They were talking about, and again, it comes back, I think, particularly in schools, to the role of the teacher as a trusted professional that can make decisions. You use the word design, which we in H2 Learning would be big fans of, that they are designing the experiences and that sometimes the experience may be that quiet corner. And it was interesting, they mentioned the importance of reading and deep reading. Actually, one of my colleagues at the event with me was from Croatia, and he spoke about, you know, critical thinking and being able to read the works of Tolstoy, right? Which I haven't read myself, but anyway. And also I'm reminded of recent research that was published by our own Department of Education with OECD, which it spoke about distraction, which is related to that skimming, you know, that we're being distracted. Yeah. And these are, any thoughts on that?
It's been shown again from research that we can't actually multitask. So we can't actually jump between three things and learn all three of them at the same time. The brain is just flicking between them. So I think the three things I would say is reading. And it's a really simple solution. And like our house here, we have about 1,500 books and they're all over the house and the children literally are falling over books. But our strategy in designing the house, if you like, was books in the corridor, books in the bedrooms, books everywhere. And we even put them down at the height that the children, so our 8-year-old is small, so all her books are down low. She walks down the corridor and pulls them out. And sometimes she just sits in the corridor on her own reading. And that's perfect. So all I'm saying is that books is the basis. And the last reference I'll make is Neil Postman. He's done a lot of research on education in the 80s. He has a book called Technopoly, which is the influence of technology on learning. And what he says is that reading in a very fundamental way shapes logical mental capacity. So we learn how to string arguments together because we see an ordered paragraph on a page where somebody said this, therefore this. And without that reading, we will struggle to develop those logical abilities. And the last thing I'll say about reading is fiction. And fiction is often underrated as if, well, that's just for pleasure reading. Whereas good fiction is actually the most important way that you learn to empathize with other human beings. Where else are you going to figure out how a human being behaved in the 17th century other than reading Emily Bronte and understanding human beings? So,
bit of problem like I say, solving in there as well, Jared, I would say.
Good problem evening. Solving, yeah.
I got a Christie, try to figure out.
Yeah, whodunit? Yeah, exactly.
But Lee, let's finish on this. I think this is fascinating because I wasn't expecting this. I think your thoughts are really interesting and I wasn't kind of expecting it to be so strong. Thinking about our education system, what I'm hearing about here really is, and I would very much subscribe to this myself, is that this, we need a balance here. You know, and we need to make sure that we are designing our schools, the physical environments, the spaces and the tools, and that we use a variety of tools and that we are not just kind of following fads and that we are ensuring that ultimately those that are in schools are engaged in learning and as much as possible that they are engaged in deep learning and that they develop these skills that they can apply in other areas of their lives outside of school and when they leave school. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, exactly. And I think we should maybe get very creative about the way in which schools are even built or the architecture is going to come into this in that I would be a big advocate of digital free zones, for example, in learning spaces, maybe even a digital free zone in your house, but spaces where Wi-Fi can't even get to. And actually, I wrote about this in my master's, but the role of architecture in creating privacy and the ability to focus in buildings. So why wouldn't we put, you know, all that thought into the design of a school? What could be more important? Yeah. So look, maybe I come across as a bit of a purist, but I suppose it's the philosophy background, and I've no problem sitting in a corner reading myself.
I think it's very timely for us to be reminded of somebody who works in a top financial fintech company, a global company, and your day job is in the whole area of data privacy and compliance, and you're sharing with us some very valuable wisdom that, yeah, I think I'm hearing, mind yourself, make sure you have time away from these devices, but you're not saying don't use them at all, far from it, but use them for the purposes where they are absolutely useful. And I think, Jared, that is a good place to finish our conversation. And I want to thank you for sharing your wisdom and your thoughts with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.